All right, so thanks for joining the session today. I'm Nate Johnson, Senior Program Manager within the Cloud Health and Security Engineering team, specifically mostly focused on Azure Government, but also do some work with Azure Commercial as well. And this is Aaron Barth, Principal Premier Field Engineer within Microsoft Services. And we're gonna be talking about how to get an agency app ATO on Azure Gov. So first, just an overview of Azure Government as a whole. So what is Azure Government? It's a dedicated cloud environment. It has all of the traditional things you would expect from an IaaS and PaaS environment, but we've leveled up some of the security and compliance requirements. So that includes physical network isolation, data center instances that are limited just to government customers. Those are managed only by U.S. persons to limit access to non-U.S. persons or actually non-U.S. citizens. And then all data is stored within the continental U.S. So we have two regions, U.S. Gov Virginia and U.S. Gov Iowa currently. And we have two additional regions that are planned for release later in 2017. But again, your data is ensured to stay only within the continental U.S. Because of these additional security requirements, we're able to meet higher compliance standards. So you can see here things like ITAR, some of the DoD SRG compliance requirements, CGIS for state and local. We make sure that we hit the highest bar so that regardless of what your compliance needs are in the unclassified space, we can accommodate those requirements from your perspective. So from a usage perspective, 100% of federal cabinet level agencies are Microsoft US cloud customers. That can include obviously smaller agencies beyond that. But from a breadth of coverage standpoint, all of these agencies you see here, as well as some of their sub-agencies, are currently using Microsoft Cloud. Similarly, all 50 states are Microsoft Cloud customers, just from a breadth of adoption standpoint, again, as far as who's using Microsoft Government Cloud. So I talked a little bit about the U.S. regions for Azure Government. This actually outlines all of the 38 Azure regions covered by both Azure Commercial as well as Azure Government. And that's just to kind of show the scale that we operate at, not just within the government environment, but also to kind of demonstrate how we can leverage lessons learned of building an actually global infrastructure and be able to incorporate that then into the government regions in the way that we do operations, the way that we do security, and the way that we're able to offer a lot of those features that are also available in our Azure Commercial environment. So again, back to the specifically Azure Government deployment. So we have two existing regions. We have two DoD dedicated regions, and those are also in Virginia and Iowa. And those are dedicated only to DoD customers. So some of the federal, state, local that are able to get subscriptions in the Azure Government environment, they are further restricted access to those dedicated DoD regions. And that's to meet DoD separation requirements that are part of the DoD SRG Level 5 requirements, so that we have dedicated hardware and dedicated regions that are only for DoD customers. And then, as I mentioned, we have two additional regions coming online in 2017, so that will be further building out our government dedicated infrastructure to now have a total of 6 regions. So express route, so when we're talking connectivity, how can you get into our data centers? How do you ensure that you have network traffic and appropriate connectivity to meet your requirements, both from a security perspective, as well as just looking at latency and potentially performance considerations? So we have 6 express route locations. Silicon Valley here is actually live now. the CAP is planned, but some of these CAP references, we're looking at the DoD cloud access points beyond just the Microsoft Express route connections. So again, if it's a DoD specific system that you're looking at to get an ATO, CAP will certainly be part of your process, I can promise you. So from a compliance and certification standpoint, again, this shows all across all industries for both Azure Government and Azure Commercial. Obviously, we're going to focus on FedRAMP and the DoD certifications with today's discussion. But again, it's making sure that we have the lessons learned and just showing that by being able to meet all of these requirements, even if it's not something specific or particular to FedRAMP or to the DoD certifications, chances are we've had to look at it from a security perspective. So, you know, we have those lessons learned as well. So for CGIS, we have coverage of more than two-thirds of the U.S. population with at least 24 states. And obviously we have some competitive analysis here for you. And then for FedRAMP, this currently says two times the services in scope. We actually now have 32 services currently within scope. We had a recent announcement expanding that. So we've even expanded the coverage within Azure Government even further. Again, just from a trusted perspective, so both Office, Azure have DoD certifications. DISA L5 was just announced earlier in 2017. And that's something that can be leveraged by using those dedicated DoD regions that I just talked about a minute ago. So another development, Azure Government Marketplace. So this makes it easier to bring in third-party solutions, third-party images, and incorporate those directly from the Azure Government portal into your Azure subscription so that you can leverage those capabilities and those images as well. And then from a release standpoint, so we've been working diligently to expand the coverage of Azure Government and make sure that from an internal features perspective, that you have available what you need to be able to design your systems. And that's shown here with some of these metrics that we have. And then from a pace of innovation perspective, it might actually be a little bit shorter than that. It's basically on a daily basis we're releasing new features. So to start out, I'm going to go through kind of an Azure Cloud ATO process overview. And then Aaron will actually go through an experience that he went through with an individual customer and kind of some of the lessons learned that he had in actually implementing some of the overall procedural things that I'll walk through as part of my presentation. So just a quick survey. So how many folks are in dedicated security and compliance? A few, okay. How many more like operations, migration, cloud expansion? Okay, a few more. And then one more, so who's government? Okay, most of you, okay. So that's good. A couple of things that this is not designed to be. This is designed to be interactive, so any questions that you have, feel free to interject. You know, we can make it more conversational. But it is not designed to be an overall, you know, FedRAMP 101 type of discussion. We have gone through both our FedRAMP JAB PATO and our DISA PA processes. They're rather lengthy, they're rather involved, they're rather expensive. We've gone through those, you know, sometimes painful processes to get to this point so that you can leverage those. if you have specific questions about that, happy to walk through that. But this is mostly designed to be, okay, now that we have those in place, what can you do as a customer to take that to the next level and be able to actually adopt an ATO your specific applications? And then the last bullet here, if there are commercial providers who are looking to get a FedRAMP ATO, to provide to government customers. We can also have that discussion potentially offline at what that process looks like and how it relates to this. So from an overall FedRAMP perspective, so one of the base tenets, both of cloud computing as well as from a FedRAMP perspective, is who holds responsibility for implementing specific security controls at different levels within the stack. So as I referenced, we have a FedRAMP JAB provisional ATO. We do all of our internal processes, procedures, protections, et cetera, within our underlying infrastructure. But then above that, you come in as a government agency, you spin up an Azure subscription in Azure Government, and you have a blank slate. So you can build virtual machines, you can leverage PaaS services, you can design essentially whatever you want using the capabilities that we've shipped and made available. But because of that, there are specific security protections, of course, that fall under your purview. So that's the main focus, is delineating those roles and responsibilities for what we do as a cloud service provider and providing insight into what we do internally so that you can have an accurate risk posture of the system that we're managing. And then also looking at the assessment of your specific Azure subscriptions and deployment the same way that you would with a current on-premises system and say, here's how we can ensure that we are managing and operating this in a secure manner as well. So essentially, this is mostly meant to demonstrate that this overall process is not different from what you're doing on-premise today. So even for those of you who are not security and compliance focused, if you've been in operations, if you've been a system owner, you know that these processes must be followed to meet FISMA requirements, internal ATO requirements. We're going through this same process. It's just that now we're involved as a cloud service provider. So we're going to walk through these six steps quickly. Again, if a lot of you are familiar with this, we'll kind of try to keep it high level. But if you have any questions as we go through, feel free to interject. So initially, we're looking at system categorization. So what is it that you need to protect? What level do you need to be at? Again, we have moderate, high, both for FedRAMP, DISA L4, DISA L5. Step one is making sure you know what your requirements are based on your data sensitivity. So some of this may be defining what type of data is going to be processed within the system. And then what is the actual data classification? So, you know, we've got CUI, FOUO, SBU, but it's really based on FIPS 199 to determine what that data sensitivity is. And until you know those requirements, you can't really move forward in the process to know what the requirements are that you have to meet. So once you have that data categorized and classified, then you can go through and determine what control baselines you must meet in order to protect that data accordingly. So FedRAMP has their security baselines established. DoD L4 and L5 have those established in the Cloud Computing Security Requirements Guide. And essentially, you need to ensure that you have the full scope of controls that you need to look at, both from a potential inheritance perspective, but also what needs to be implemented within your subscription. So then we get to control implementation. So this is really the first step where you get more into that shared responsibilities type of model. So when you're looking at control implementation, you need to know, is that something that Azure Government is going to implement on your behalf? Or is that something that you need to go in and keep in mind as you're architecting, deploying, and operating your system? So the text here is rather small. Actually going to click over to a version of the customer responsibilities matrix that we have available. And again, this text may not be super readable, but essentially what we do is we break it down to the granular NIST 853 sub-requirement level. So we're not just saying account management, AC2, you need to think about how to manage your accounts. We say, you know, within AC2, there's requirements A through M or something along those lines. So we break it down to that level of granularity to document where it is that you may have a potential control responsibility. And we list those out explicitly one by one to make sure that you know where it is that you need to keep these kinds of architectural decisions and management considerations in mind. And then along with that, while we're sharing the documentation, so the other thing that we have is a system security plan that outlines what we do from an implementation perspective that can be inherited. So this is in a FedRAMP SSP template so that it can potentially be used to document your internal security plans. And just as one example, so if we look at like physical and environmental controls, here we actually outline what we do from a PE perspective, which essentially comes down to data center security that you can leverage and inherit, and then where there may still be a potential control responsibility that's outlined as well for the customer. So then we get to the assessment and testing portion. So there are two potential steps from this perspective. So part of it is accepting the risk associated with leveraging Azure Government. We provide our full FedRAMP package to any government agency who's interested in reviewing what's already been approved through the FedRAMP Joint Authorization Board. That's comprised of GSA, DOD, and DHS. But those results and the associated risks or vulnerabilities are all outlined in our FedRAMP package. That's available for your review as a government agency. And then the second step is then assessing how you've implemented security controls within your individual subscription and how that layers on top of the risk posture that we have within Azure Government. So then we get to the authorization point. This is where everyone wants to get to the finish line. This is where you can go to production. This is where you get the signature and everybody can celebrate and enjoy the fact that the process is over and you've made it. And then you get to keep doing it some more. So from a monitoring perspective, obviously you've signed, but as part of continuous monitoring requirements, you need to continue to monitor the risk posture of the system on an ongoing basis. So that includes things like scanning requirements, potentially ongoing authorization considerations, and then any of the agency implemented controls that would be leveraged within your individual subscription as well. So all of this feeds into something that you may have heard of in other presentations known as Azure Blueprint. The whole program is designed to essentially streamline customer secure deployment and certification of applications that are built on Azure Government. So the whole idea is streamlining the process that I just outlined by providing information, resources to answer any questions you may have, and essentially make that as easy as possible as you walk through that process. So there are a few different ways that we're going about doing this. One is through secure architectures, so looking at things like Azure Resource Manager templates that you can potentially leverage as a baseline starting point for your system. Then we also have deployment guidance, which is available publicly, where we say here are potential ways that you can leverage Azure services to meet your control requirements as a customer. Certification, so this is the type of documentation that I was sharing just a few minutes ago, where we have customer responsibilities matrices, system security plan templates, and things that you can potentially use to streamline that documentation piece of it. And then expertise, so we have folks available to answer individual questions, and walk you through kind of some of the procedural things and provide high-level expertise. And then we also have partners who we've worked with from a consulting and contracting standpoint who have deep knowledge of Azure Government. They can come in if you require, documentation development, potentially architectural design, things of that nature. We can connect you with those folks as well. And then from a coverage standpoint, obviously, given the dominance of government within this session, primarily we'd be looking at federal, civilian, and U.S. defense here. But it is something that we're expanding to cover more compliance frameworks and additional items in the commercial space as well. Yes. Okay, so the question was essentially within an individual agency, can we work with your CISO, your internal IA type personnel to make sure that, you know, we work through them with the process? Absolutely. So the best way to get us connected is, one thing is to try to do it early in the process, because, you know, when we're talking architecture, you know, if you design and build out the entire system and then you get production ready and then you start tying in those folks, then you're going to have a long way to go. So we're happy to have a lot of those discussions. You know, from an expertise standpoint, we participate in a lot of overall Azure government briefings where we can come in, partner with, you know, some of the account teams who may be working with your agency currently, and walk through what are the security protections that we have in place, what are the procedural things we need to consider. And we certainly recommend doing that as early in the process, because that way we can make sure that all of the stakeholders are involved and tied in as we walk through migration and or deployment. Yes, so we are tied in very closely with a lot of our account executives. If you choose to reach out directly to us, you can reach out to azureblueprint@microsoft.com. If we haven't been tied in already with those account teams, then we can make that connection and start those discussions as well. Yes? Sure. So the question is, from a controls perspective, if you've got potentially some on-premise considerations, you've also got cloud considerations, how do you manage both on-premise, you know, and cloud from like a configuration management type standpoint? So we would look at that as potentially a shared responsibility. So something like change management or configuration management, you know, you're looking at CM3 for some of those processes and procedures. So we would look at that and say, we have internal processes and procedures that we do for CM3, so that's the Azure piece. Then you may have on-premise configuration management processes, procedures, et cetera, that you do for your on-premise systems. You have the opportunity to leverage that same control response, and actually Aaron may get into this a little bit in the future with his slides, but you can leverage those same CM3 responses if you choose to from a procedural standpoint, but you can also have a customer-specific response for on-premise and a customer-specific response for within Azure Government. So how do you get access to the spreadsheet? So one of the things we're doing from this perspective within Azure Blueprint, so we have all of the considerations where you may have a customer responsibility outlined. If you're doing a hybrid versus cloud capability, that would potentially be specific to your individual deployment. We're happy to have those discussions, not from a services standpoint, but just from an overall Azure Blueprint shared responsibility model. If it is getting deep into the weeds of technical implementation and additional things of that nature, then we may need to get more specific with what the question is, and if we can set up an overall model for how that type of governance would work, or if it actually needs to be an individual control by control type of investigation into that.
So you'll go through a couple of solution alignment workshops, and then you'll figure it all out to a certain level of view. Who's responsible for what? Yeah. It's not out of the box. There's going to be some pain.
Yes.
You had an earlier slide where you talked about Azure Government was certified on L4 and L5.
Yes.
So
the question is, with DoD L4 and L5, is that Azure Gov, or is that just the dedicated DoD regions?
Correct.
So Azure Government is certified to DoD L4, as well as FedRAMP High. So that's just within Azure Government. The DoD regions, because L5 has that isolation requirement, those are certified at level 5. But all of Azure Government is not level 5. I will caveat that by saying we've architected the solution the same outside of that physical isolation. So the security protections, generally speaking, are the same within Azure Government. It's not certified because we can't meet that DoD isolation within all of Azure Government.
Okay, so if we have our IA officers who want to put us in L4 category as opposed to the L2 category, before my understanding was if you're L2, you could go Azure and not have to go into DoD cloud. Is that still the case, or can we do L4 in Azure Government?
Sure. So just to repeat the question for anyone who didn't hear it. So the question is, previously there was an understanding that if you were going L2, you could go just within Azure Government. If the system and the data is classified as L4, can you still go within Azure Government without being in the dedicated DoD regions?
Correct.
Absolutely. So we are at L4 within Azure Government. And you can use that environment and our US Gov regions, not our US DoD regions, to cover L4 requirements.
Thank you. So when you say Azure L5, are you talking about ITAR?
No.
Azure have an ITAR?
So the question is, when I'm saying L5, am I referencing ITAR? So level 5 would be separate. Level 5 is a DoD categorization just for potentially national security systems that are still only processing unclassified data. That is separate from ITAR requirements, which are met across all of Azure Government. So we meet ITAR requirements. We enable ITAR compliance across Azure Government, not just within those L5 DoD regions. Okay. Turn it over to Aaron.
Okay. Great. So I'm in Microsoft Services, and I work with agencies to help them sort of navigate this process, both from what comes down from the Azure product group to the customer, and then sort of how to navigate the documentation and some of the controls and definitions and things like that. So just to sort of frame out the next part of my time here. I'm going to first talk a little bit about terminologies, things that get a little bit confusing to, like the word ATO. We'll kind of talk about the different types of ATOs there are and sort of which ones we're dealing with in each situation. Then we'll talk about sort of the steps to certification. One of the steps is planning, of course. The next step is not necessarily documented in FedRAMP or anything, but it's really getting connected to the actual environment. Because this is in a cloud environment, it's not guaranteed that you're automatically going to be able to just connect on any port you want to any virtual machine that's in there from within the agency. Then you're going to build out the environment. And then once the environment's built, you can take these steps to document what was built and how to certify that application. And then we'll talk about, you know, the various resources that are there, and I'd love to entertain questions as we go through the discussion. So let's talk about terminology. There's the concept of a JAB ATO. Nate has referred to it. This is going to come from Azure Government, or Azure, and Microsoft to FedRAMP. So they're going to get actually everything certified, the data centers, the processes and things that are in place. You guys seen the video with the data center where you walk through and you have all the protections for the actual physical security of the data centers. That's all sort of covered under the JAB ATO, and that is now for Azure Government at high. It was at moderate, now it's at high as well. So that's the certification that, you know, for any service, let's say, you know, Azure Government, but there's also like CRM Online Government. That needs to go, you know, has actually gone through this ATO process as well. So cloud services that you get are going to have the sort of certification from FedRAMP. Then we have the agency ATO. And you guys, you know, within the agencies that you guys are a part of, you may be in this phase where there is a FedRAMP ATO for a specific service out there that agencies can then consume, but the agency that you're in may or may not have certified that they want to accept the risks that are actually documented in the whole of the controls and with the ISOs and CISOs to actually say, look, yes, we're going to use Azure Government, and we have an ATO in the agency as a whole. Then there's this new thing we're going to talk about for the, which is called a Cloud Workload ATO. And the names can change. It can be just called an Application ATO. But it kind of helps sort of frame the discussion that it's a Cloud Workload ATO, which is sort of, you know, what you're going to be doing in the cloud, right? You're going to process it's going to be a system. You're going to process data. You know, you're going to, what's it actually going to do, and who's going to have access to the environment? And you know, what are your policies and procedures going to be in place for that system, right? Just because you're using Azure, you know, let's say you're using Azure, you sign up for Azure Government, you get an Azure Active Directory. Well, who are you going to put in that Azure Active Directory? Are you going to sync it with your domain? Those are questions we're going to talk about a little bit further when you start thinking about how that can fit into your overall system architecture. And you could have multiple systems, multiple workloads running within an agency that are sort of sharing some resources. And when you share resources, you get some benefits of leveraging controls that are being used there and that are documented. You document it once, you then can reuse it throughout the agency. So that's where the Cloud Workload ATO concept comes in. Any questions? Great. So why should cloud applications obtain Cloud Workload ATOs? Why should an agency, you know, care to create an ATO? And it really boils down to, you know, really three things. You're going to have the confidentiality of the data, right? You're going to have the integrity of the system. And then you're going to make sure that the system's available. All those kind of things, those are the controls you're going to see a little bit later on as well for categorization of a system. But those are really important things that you need to sort of take into account when you're trying to say, you know, why would I want to certify an application? So the steps toward certification, and this is sort of a working model. It's not necessarily defined by anyone but my experience within agencies. And feel free to sort of have a discussion on, you know, other things you would put in certain places. But we talked about planning, you know, designing the actual application, the boundary identification. If you guys were in the recent Express Route conversation, you really talk about boundaries there. The identity, and then, of course, the access control policies that are going to be in place within that. Then you have the connectivity. You can work with the network operations team within the agency to open up the ports, and are you allowed to communicate on certain ports and what IP address ranges are being used. Then you actually build the application out, and then you have the documentation sort of processes that you go through for the categorization, the security control documentation, and then possibly running some scans in the environment if they're required. So let's move into the planning phase. We can look at workloads, the management responsibility, the identity configuration, and access control. And I'll briefly kind of go through these as we move through. So not really telling anyone probably anything new, but you know, the workloads we have in place, you have on-premise workloads. And you can have hybrid things where you're actually integrating in a system with cloud and on-premise. That's, you know, totally something you can do, and it's something you want to take into account. you have the IaaS workloads, infrastructure as a service, where you have a lot more control over the environment. You can build out Windows machines, you can build out Linux machines, and you're really sort of handling it kind of like where you would within IT for the agency as a whole. And then you have platform as a service applications, where you really have less controls to worry about because a lot of the things are taken care of by the platform. And those are some of the benefits we're gonna look at. And then finally, you have software as a service like Office 365 services that you really have provided for you. They meet all the controls or most of the controls that you have there besides, let's say, who you're going to give access to what system within that. So within the IaaS workloads, we have compute, storage, and the networking capabilities, those base capabilities. Virtual machines, but also one could think about, for IaaS, you could also think about containers, right? That's kind of a newer concept that people have, and you could have a container image that sort of operates like an IaaS workload because it has those things in there. Then we have the PaaS workloads, which is the sort of eye chart where you have services for security and management, PaaS services, application platform is sort of in the middle there. And then, developer services as well as IoT and analytics services. If you haven't seen that chart, you can pull the slides later. And then you have the hybrid cloud services as well, where you would sort of integrate between the two of them using, let's say, BizTalk or Service Bus or something like that. And then you have the SaaS workloads. And the reason why I'm talking about these is because when you think about a system, you can have a system that can have IaaS components that you're building, right? But then you may reach out to, let's say, a data warehouse service or SQL Azure service. Well, that's a PaaS service that now's in your system architecture. So now you have to kind of think about how those controls are going to be sort of in play. And one could also use, Exchange Office 365 or CRM Online or Power BI in a system that you'd want to have certified. So those are controls that you may want to look at as well. Yes, sir. So it's interesting talking about these are integration systems where if you had, let's say, CRM Online can be almost like a building block type platform. So let's say you ran some code in CRM Online that was calling out to a PaaS service in Azure Government, that would be sort of part of your cloud workload ATO. I guess it would be up to per agency. I think they handle the agency ATO would probably cover the SaaS service that you're looking at. But when you start doing integration, let's say SharePoint Online, you write custom web parts that interact with certain things, and your applications become a little more complex, one could think that an ATO would be required, and someone would say, well, wait a minute, I'm sending data to CRM Online. Is that in my accreditation boundary? Or is that going over the big I, somewhere else, right? So you still have to kind of, what you may see is you may see people pull these certification packages from FedRAMP, your ISO and your network team and everything. You can, as an agency, you can pull those packages and start looking at what the evidence is for the traffic flows and all that data. So that's why I'm mentioning that they're important to sort of know that they're there and that you can reference them on there. There's also we mentioned sort of these services. Some of these services may be built on Azure Government, which has its ATO in the actual data center. It's called GSGO, which actually you can look in FedRAMP. You can see CRM Online is based on the Azure Government data center sort of work. So great question. Any other questions just on what were these workloads that we're talking about? But that surprised you a little bit that you might need to think about it?
It makes sense. If it extends beyond the boundary that's in the PATO, that makes sense.
Great. You had a question, sir? You have to look at those network flows, right?
Yeah, but you're looking, I guess if you're just serving a single agency, then wouldn't that fall under the traditional SCA process and ATO process for that agency because of all of the...
So the question is that if you're using SaaS, I'm trying to paraphrase, if you're using SaaS services and it's only within the same agency, then does that fall within, you know, do you have to worry about additional certifications, or does it fall within the same, you know, ATO for the actual SaaS service?
Mm-hmm. If all of the clients are within one federal agency and you're sitting on top of, like, Azure, which has gone through the provisional ATO process, wouldn't an agency ATO essentially
cover it, you're thinking? So one thing that I'm seeing in just the agencies that I'm working with, and it could be different for other agencies, is that there's also a risk management system where an application needs to essentially go live and meet some requirements, right? So because you're building code or you're actually deploying an application within the boundary, you know, within the agency, and it's using agency data, then the risk management team starts looking as like, wait a minute, are you meeting the controls that we talked about? And we're going to go into a little bit deeper into my experience with those types of controls as we move forward, and maybe be able to circle back to that. But
so it can I jump in?
Yeah.
So
please.
So I have a little bit of a cheating background because I know where you're coming from a non-government perspective. Generally speaking, if it is within one agency and you're building on behalf of that agency, then it would be under that agency's purview. It would not be under a provisional authorization type of consideration. So that agency may look at it from a, you know, IaaS and PaaS perspective as well as a SaaS perspective within that individual agency. But generally speaking, you would not necessarily have to go out and get a provisional authorization as a third-party commercial provider to let that agency leverage what it is that you're building. Does that help?
Correct, right? You may not need that middle part, which is the agency ATO you're talking about, right?
No, I'm saying you don't need to go for the JAB provisional ATO.
Got it. Okay. The far right, got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Makes sense. And we can circle back. So let's talk a little bit. Yeah,
did we you have another?
Yes, please.
Consult your internal IA personnel.
Right. But there is layering that happens.
Yes.
Right,
in a perfect world, yep, you should be able to leverage the risk posture at a minimum of the analysis that's been done for Azure or Azure Government. Now, from a workload perspective, if you're building something completely different than they've already done, you may have two completely different risk postures for those workloads. But from a reciprocity standpoint, it's certainly beneficial when you can connect with those other teams that have gone through that and be able to leverage the reviews that they've already conducted.
Right. Yes. Yep. But one thing to keep in mind is also that because Azure Government meets the certification requirements in various levels, like say, we'll talk about identity, right? If you spin up your own identity in IaaS, right now you're sort of, you know, overriding what identity was, or adding to the other identity that was already in Azure and Azure Active Directory. Now you have to handle a lot of the access control and sort of, you know, requirements for managing that as if you're like almost your own company, you know, handling that. So you have to think about whether you leverage the agency's IT team, IT staff, IT policies, or does it sort of become an independent system that then, you know, you have to kind of think about, what if someone leaves? How do you make sure you know that they left so you can remove them, you know, and expire passwords and things like that? So sometimes, you know, just saying, you know, leveraging something, you have to make sure that you can sort of understand where you may be overriding some controls or to take a special look at it. So, yes.
Looking at getting a provisional ATO for what you're building on top of that,
You have to keep in mind what Matt Goodrich said in a recent webcast, I think in December, related to there's 12 slots in January for who's going to get on the list for going through the PATO process. And then again, 6 months later, there's another 12 slots. So, you know, if your agency or your stakeholders need it before, you know, you're likely to make the cut for one of those slots, then the agency ATO might be the way to go at it, even if later on you plan on offering it.
Yeah. There's definitely different ways, you know, to sort of to get the ATO within the agency or to assume the risk of using those services, and you can sort of, you know, take a look at that. What we're sort of looking at with the workload itself is that, you know, the workload, we're going to look at some of the scenarios and some of the factors to think about when you're sort of building that workload, so you can understand sort of where those controls can come into play. So you guys may have seen this a similar slide, probably not in the same color, but this explains a little bit about, you know, why you would start looking at something like platform as a service or software as a service. The actual customer side is the blue side of the things you manage. So on premises, you're managing everything all the way down to the data center and networking and servers and everything. But infrastructure, you start now, okay, you're just managing the operating system, the virtualization layers taken care of by Azure. And as you start moving to platform, then the orange place, you know, actually increases for what Microsoft is managing on your behalf. And then really you're dealing with the application and the data. So think about the controls required in order to sort of manage the application and the data. It's like, okay, I got that. You know, and then when you move to SaaS, you're saying, hey, Microsoft, you're going to manage the entire system for me. The risk posture, you know, handling incidents, whatever it is, you're actually handling that as a software as a service. So I just want to kind of share that with you guys. And we're going to revisit this and look at a little bit at where the controls fit in, you know, if we have time to go through that. So that was the actual, you know, who manages the various layers. Now we're going to look a little bit at identity, sort of, and some questions you can ask yourself. So how is your identity configured? In some cases, you may be using synchronization with Active Directory, with your actual agency's Active Directory, or you can do, you know, federation, where you have, you know, the idea is to have an NADFS server that would then do the, you know, sort of the lookup back down to your Active Directory in order to sort of keep those identities. Or, you know, a third option would be what I was talking about before, where you spin up, you know, an IaaS AD that is only worked, you know, used for cloud, this actual cloud workload, totally independent. And there's some risks with that in the sense that now you're essentially an IT team handling what you would normally do, you know, the whole agency's IT team would be working on. So that's just something to think about when you're, you know, looking at identity and the various controls that are there. And then we talk about access control. Azure has a fantastic access control model, and there's lots of documentation on that where it's called RBAC, right? So you can go ahead and role-based access control for RBAC. You can, within the subscription, you can create readers and contributors and owners, and you can lock it down all the way down to the resource group level. And that answers some of the controls that we're talking about in the, you know, in the actual security support plan that you may have to fill out for your cloud workload ATO, for how am I sort of restricting access to only certain things, and, you know, who has access to what. And it's very important to know that the RBAC can help with that. And then, finally, you know, we actually, sorry, let me step back a second. So connectivity, how is the app connected? How does the data flow from the application? And then, you know, ultimately, how can I actually access the application itself? So, you know, what ports need to be allowed in order to do what type of communication? And this is where, you know, your networking hat kind of gets put on. I'm an app dev guy, so being in this space is a little foreign to me, but I had to kind of get, you know, ramped up pretty quick on it. So if you were in the ExpressRoute conversation previously, right before lunch, we talked a little bit about ExpressRoute. And, you know, the agencies I work with, some are using ExpressRoute and some are using VPN. But really what this is that, you know, when you think about how I'm accessing my private peering, which is the like the actual VNets in that are actually available for the Azure government, versus public peering, which would be something like the SQL Azure databases or the the Azure websites or Service Bus or whatever else in the public peering space. You have to kind of think when you're doing your workload ATO, how is data going to start flowing between these environments? And so it's helpful to know, let's say for an agency that does have ExpressRoute, what those look like. And then sort of an example of that is, how does the data flow from the agency network down below in the lower left, to, over the ExpressRoute to, let's say, maybe like a centralized subscription to handle the ExpressRoute connection. And then you can route between multiple VNets within that for the data. But then when you think about the PaaS services, do you come back all the way back down the express route and go out to the PaaS service? Or in some cases, might you whitelist, allow a direct path from your VNet, out to the PaaS services? Those are sort of, interesting things to think about when you're looking at a cloud workload and really where is your data stored and what are you talking to? It is kind of the nitty-gritty of how things are actually routed, but unfortunately, within agencies and network operations teams, they care about that stuff, how it routes. And then, ultimately, what ports need to be allowed. So this is just a pretty simple example of you have an Azure, a virtual network on the left-hand side, and you have an ExpressRoute connection between that, and then you have an on-premises agency. But when you think about it, in some cases, dealing with government agencies, traffic is not just permitted by default to any IP address to any port. So you have to really understand, what do I need in order to connect? Like if I'm using Active Directory and I'm doing a domain join machine out here to a domain in the agency, what ports do I need in order to open in order to do that? And you really need to work closely with your networking teams to kind of understand what that is, if it's not already just open outbound or inbound. And in this case, you can set up, on the actual, connection, you can actually set up ports for HTTPS in this case for the web servers or RDP, which would be just sort of like a jump box in order to manage the environment from within there. So those sort of ports and things like that, there's a process in some of the agencies I work with, like a control process where you have to go and request these, and it could be a couple, weeks or months, to actually get these things approved and actually put evidence that you are going to use these ports and that's what you need. But I've gone through a couple slides. Any questions on the last ones that I talked about? Pretty clear? Is it scary? Yes, sir. Okay, so SLA for a PaaS service? Question was, or the response was about SLAs.
Right now.
Okay, yeah, and I guess it would depend on how you get there, like we talked about before, in the ExpressRoute connection, or if it's if it's just on the internet itself and there's an SLA there. Those are actually things to keep in mind. Great point. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we're gonna get to build, so it's not that most of it. Not a very exciting slide, but when you're building in Azure, you can use ARM templates to build out your solutions so that it's repeatable. You can audit those ARM templates themselves. You can store them in a code repository like Git or Visual Studio Team System, and then you can deploy, test, and then you want to go through your testing, and finally you want to make sure that your application, as far as the controls, you have auditing and you're logging data so that access is really clear. So finally, we'll get to the document and certify section, talk about system categorization, customer controls, the ATO personas, and then finally, the ATO documents themselves. So system categorization, Nate mentioned this, the FIPS 199 document, where really we talked about CIA, the confidentiality, integrity, and availability. The system owner needs to go ahead and mark the system categorization, and then the ISO would then sort of validate that, in fact, the data that you're putting in there meets those needs. And you take the highest one. So let's say, for example, you know, your confidentiality is moderate, but your availability is low or something, you're going to be probably a moderate system, and you need to sort of look at that. That determines how many controls you have to then answer for in your customer responsibility that we'll look at next. So for customer controls, this is just an example of the high controls that are customer or shared responsibilities that need to be sort of have answers. And the far right, you can see it's just sort of like access controls in blue and configuration management's in orange. That's like 66 and 74 controls for high. So high is very high bar for data, and that's why the categorization is so important to understand, because as you said, it takes a long time to go through the process. It takes a little bit longer for high than it does for moderate, and you don't want to go down this whole process and document controls you don't really have to sort of document if you're at a moderate state. I think moderate's like 300 something or so.
So moderate is this one. Yeah, so moderate's 325, and then for high, it's actually 421 total controls. This would be potentially the sub-requirement level where you'd be looking at a portion of AC2. Part of this 74, you could have multiple portions of the same AC2 overall control that you would need to keep in mind here.
Yeah, like AC2, like A and AC2B or whatever it is. If you keep those together, then they're, you'd have less, but his number's right. Mine's just the ones that I saw. So this is that slide again, right? So, but it's a little bit different in the sense that, the entire system is system and information integrity, the SI control, but then you start thinking about the infrastructure and platform. It's not looking at SaaS at all. It's just infrastructure and platform, and the left columns are infrastructure as a service. The right two columns are platform, and you can see in here that the thing to think keep in mind for platform is your identity, your IA, your auditing, and your actual access control of who has access to the system. So it's kind of looking at the same similar thing. And then the ones that are sort of blended, those are shared controls that you need to sort of make sure that you have a handle on. You can't sort of walk away from them, just because it's IaaS and they say, the servers and storage and everything are taken care of. An example for that would be let's say contingency planning, CP, storage, you could turn on the geo-replication in the storage side, and then you could go ahead and, you could meet that need, and then you document that control as meeting, the geo-replication storage request, for the data itself. Another one would be, let's say, just access, access control. In the middleware is something like Azure Active Directory, things like that. You could actually enable that for the PaaS service, which is why on the far right it sort of has a blended view there. But it's just sort of, it's not exact. There's probably other ones in there. It wouldn't really fit in the diagram to have them all in there. But it's just kind of give you an idea of things. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the physical environment, PE, in Azure is taken care of, right? So, because of the locked doors and the biometric scanners and things like that are all handled at the PE level. This is an example of a control, and this is also part of the compliance documentation that Azure Government puts out there to sort of help you understand how you could write a control response. This is IA5-1A, and really it's talking about the enforcement for a required password complexity. Right, that can be implemented via a group policy object in Active Directory in order to do that. And you can say, we're doing that, and then we've implemented it, and these are the sort of examples on how to do it. Just to read that out quickly, the customer will be responsible for enforcing the required password complexity. Microsoft Azure Active Directory solution may be used for this purpose. A successful control response will need to address the mechanism used to enforce the complexity. So that's sort of like an example of, you know, one of the controls that would need to be documented, and then you add that into your sort of your customer security plan, and then the ATO process is used there. So questions on those? You can pull the slides when they're available, or review the in order to kind of get more information. But any questions? We'll move into the personas and then kind of wrap up. So these are just from the agencies that I was working with, sort of an example of the types of personas that exist for this risk framework process. So there's an app owner, there's an agency ISO, there's an ATO board, a risk management board, and then there's just the implementation team. So the app owner, they're responsible for describing the system, responsible for requesting you know, and submitting any code that's available. They're responsible for bringing the application to the risk management framework ATO board, and they're responsible for all the controls in the customer responsibility matrix. And that's the thing that that Nate was talking about, you can get from Microsoft, and then an agency can then brand that to their own needs as they want to say, hey, look, we're going to use this process for certifying applications. So the next one is the agency ISO. And the agency ISO is then going to sort of validate that the categorization is correct based on the data and the data flows that they understand. They're going to provide the templates and forms needed in order to sort of move through this ATO process. And they're also going to act as an advocate on the board to sort of, you know, from a technical perspective and from a security perspective, for the system owner to be able to sort of answer questions that may come up at the sort of the risk management board meeting. And then finally, we talked about monitoring. The ISO is probably going to be the one who has to make sure that all the ATO documentation and everything is sort of revisited and monitored on a regular basis, depending on what the security categorization is. Then we have the ATO board. And the ATO board is, you know, it could be called something else, a risk management board or something. An agency may have one in order to sort of bring application authority to operate certification for applications. They're going to go ahead and determine, you know, whether the CSP, the cloud service provider, actually meets the FedRAMP certifications that are there. You may have another provider come in and say, we're going to host your data, but they may not be in FedRAMP, and sort of risk management board will sort of, you know, sort that out. And then they'll approve adding sort of the application to the registry of applications for the agency. If an ISO hasn't been assigned, they'll actually assign the ISO for the for that process as well. And then finally, we have the implementation team. They're the guys that do the work. They get the go-ahead, they're going to implement the application. They probably have to document the application because they're the ones who know how it works the best. In some guidance for the agency, we said that the controls will be documented by the ISO and like the systems architect, so they, you know, who really understands the application pretty well. They'd be part of the implementation team. And they would address any issues found from like any code scans or something like that that would be there. And then they'd also bring the application live and push the button to be able to move it forward. And then finally, this is, I think, the last slide before questions, sort of the layering we talked about, right, where you can take the FedRAMP accreditation package from FedRAMP.gov, and the agency can take that, let's say, for the commercial cloud, Azure Government, and like Dynamics CRM Online for government. You could sort of, if you were building an application with those things, the agency can kind of take those. Then the agency has sending, you know, an agency ATO letter accepting the FedRAMP documentation. They've reviewed it. They are ready to sort of move forward. And they just would sort of, this would be their process to accept the existing the ATOs that are available on FedRAMP.gov. And then you have, you know, the application docs in the upper right. And then the customer responsibility, which are all those controls and documentations, plus possible scans for, let's say, the database or the web scans and everything, that all sort of gets put together and gets pushed into sort of, you know, the application ATO. The storage of this process could be, you know, different systems that agencies can use. And some agencies haven't really embraced, you know, like FedRAMP such that they would be able to do this type of layering. But this would be my suggestion, you know, to sort of suggest to the agencies and things that you would want to layer to reduce the amount of work required, so you can say, hey, look, we've done it for our agency. This is how you would typically, you know, enable a cloud service. We're leveraging the same capabilities, and you're not sort of reinventing the wheel over and over and over again. Because this is something that could really, you know, save time if it's done right. That's all I have. And open for questions on anything for myself and Nate. Let's get one in the back and then we'll get to you. Yes, sir. Do you have that, civilian agencies that have gone through?
Yeah, the question was, do we have a list of civilian agencies who have gone through this in production? So that was all of Microsoft Cloud. If you're looking for lessons learned, probably the best way would be for us to connect and see if there are either individuals within your actual agency who have gone through it, or if there are other government folks who we can connect you with to have those discussions. So you can do one of two things. Generally speaking, to the crowd, you can email azureblueprint@microsoft.com, and we can have those discussions. But if you'd like to follow up offline right after the presentation, we can do that as well.
Yeah, great. And sir?
Yeah, just on your previous slide, the documentation at the end of the day when all of this is compiled, is the person that's receiving that someone like the at the agency level, or
No, the agency level. The agency is accepting the responsibility for a running system. That's a great question. So who's actually receiving all this stuff? You know, where does it go? And in this case, it's really trying to model or fit FedRAMP on top of an existing risk management framework system that the agency already has.
So workloads don't generally get submitted to the PMO?
Okay. So workloads generally do not get submitted to the PMO. The one caveat I'll say is that if an agency is issuing a workload or application ATO on top of a FedRAMP service, then because that's included in the stack, the agency is supposed to report that ATO just for the FedRAMP service as part of that overall workload accreditation. So that's general FedRAMP guidelines, is to provide that. You would not provide your workload or application specific ATO documentation to FedRAMP.
So another point of where it could possibly reside, one example, and this is all sort of getting fixed or figured out through the agencies, is like at some point there needs to be an agency ATO and all the documentation, all the controls that are met for the actual Azure government FedRAMP package and everything needs to be stored somewhere in the agency, so like where they reviewed it or whatever it was. And in this case, it was a risk management system where the ATO was given for Azure government as a whole. And underneath that, there may be sort of the ability to sort of attach documentation for the actual systems that are using that as well. That would be just one example. Now, as that grows over time, and there's so many of them, it may be unwieldy to do that. And hopefully, they'll sort of create some ability to kind of reference the documentation somewhere else so that you can do that. Oh, great.
If you have a cloud service provider, and I believe on a competitor's side, they have some documentation in terms of how that control is implemented. Mm-hmm. Do you know if Microsoft, if agencies require in their ATO management system, if they require details as to how certain controls are implemented within Azure, what does Microsoft generate?
Oh, yeah, that's that SSP blueprint that you can help
sure.
us write.
Sure. So, yeah, the question is, if agencies require an implementation statement for how a control is implemented when it's inherited and how they can incorporate that into their documentation systems, so one of two things. So we have our overall FedRAMP package that includes how we implement all of the controls internally. We can provide that directly to any government agency. We see that as a general model in those types of tools where they need to import that into the tool. They need to then be able to reference that this control is inherited.
Okay, so Microsoft's okay with them importing it into the tool
So the question is, are we okay with having that be imported into the tool that will then be referenced by contractors who are working in the environment? So generally speaking, yes. We are, because some of the content is somewhat sensitive, we provide that material directly to government agencies with the understanding that, you know, we have agreements with the agencies on how they will or will not use that. Contractors also have certain non-disclosure agreements that would be associated with the work that they would be doing. So generally we provide it directly to agencies, and then assuming that there is a certain level of assurance and protection going along with that, they can be able to use that to leverage their mission needs.
Great. And is there questions in the back or anyone? You guys good? Cool. All right. So this is the final resources slide. And thank you guys very much for attending. Feel free to come up and ask any questions if you have any.